Hello and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast from your very good friends at Books of the Year, which is a podcast.
Yes, as we do say.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And has been universally declared the number one books podcast in the UK, Western Europe, and most of the Americas.
Most of the Americas as well. Wow, we're spreading our tentacles.
Yep, that's right. I'm sure we should be doing live shows around the world, but in the meantime, we'll just carry on as normal. It's an email from Jane in Deal in Kent. Hello, boys. Love the pod. Quick one from me. I'm off to Cornwall in June, and I want to take a book with me. I'm not a fast reader, so I'll only get through one book in a week, but I am torn between two, and both of them featured on your pod. I know you're not allowed to have favourites. I think we probably are.
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
But I'd be keen to know which one you think I should take with me. Think remote cottage, big garden, lots of tea, long walks, you get the picture. The two novels I am keen on are The Killing Stones by Anne Cleves.
Yes, oh, yes.
I know that you said read it at Christmas. That's because it's set at Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
The Art of a Lie by Laura Shepherd Robinson. I'd appreciate your wisdom.
Okay, well, this is going to be no surprise when I say The Art of a Lie, because that was my favourite book from last year. But the other reason why you should go for that one, Jane, is because the character at the centre of that is bringing ice cream to Edwardian Britain. And what better book to be reading in the gorgeous sunshine on your holiday in Cornwall than a book that involves a lot of ice cream?
Yeah, I disagree. I would say go with The Killing Stones by Anne Cleves, because I know it's set at Christmas and there isn't a lot of ice cream in there.
Yes, go on.
But as an introduction to Jimmy Perez's character, I think what it'll then give you an option to do is to go back and discover all the other books that Jimmy Perez has been in. So that although it's just the one book, it has the option of spreading into others.
I suppose there's a point here, isn't there, that if you race through that book because you love it so much, you might just go to whichever bookshop is nearest on your holiday and say, I'll have more of that, please. An email from Stephen Risby. Dear Simon and Matt, I recently listened to the author John Lanchester on your pod, and in the Q&A episode, he recommended a book called Drayton and Mackenzie by Alexander Starrett. I was very taken with his description of it, a rare book about male friendship and business, and went straight out and bought it. Okay, I went straight to my phone and ordered it online, but let's not split hairs. The book is brilliant. I flew through it as a retired MD of a business that I started with my friend. I got a lot out of this novel. Thank you, John, for the recommendation, and thank you both for the brilliant pod.
Okay, we're always interested to hear what you have to say. Get in touch. You can do that by emailing booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Did I make that clear enough?
Yes.
booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Let us know what you're reading, what you're enjoying. Pass on some advice. We're also on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Books of the Year. Now to welcome our very special guest for this episode, an international superstar author who has sold over 90 million
90
books.
90 million.
Here we go. Yes, let's talk to Michael Connolly. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I just went to the Edgar Awards last night in New York City.
And what happened there? Did you win lots of prizes?
No, I wasn't up for any prize. I was there in, I guess you could call support, to cheer for my friend Lee Child, who got the Grandmaster Award, which is kind of a
Grandmaster. Wow.
Wow. Yeah. What is that? Does he get a robe and a crown or something? What happens if you're the grandmaster?
We get a nice trophy, and I guess that's about it. you get a lot of people surrounding you and accolades from your friends.
He probably went out and celebrated with Burger King and chips, which I think, as I recall, is probably his favorite slap-up meal.
He's still a really skinny guy, so I'm not sure he's eating french fries.
Yeah, cigarettes and coffee probably for the rest of the time. So Michael's new book is called Ironwood. Matt, describe the cover here. What are we looking at?
Yeah, so we're looking at, I'm going to say this is sunset, Michael, but you might want to put me right here. So the majority of that front cover is taken up with a sunset. We've got the blue sky at the top and then the reds and orange and yellow. So that takes up pretty much three quarters of the front cover. But your eye is going to be drawn to a single prop plane, which is coming into land, and you're standing on the runway, and bluntly, if you stay on that runway for 1 second more, you're going to get hit by this plane. Michael Connelly in big bold white letters at the top, Ironwood in gold, and then the number one Sunday Times bestseller. Richard Osman says an incredible writer. Lee Child, Grandmaster Lee Child,
yes,
says a superb natural storyteller, and the Express at the bottom say the master of modern crime fiction.
Well, that is the cover. Let's look at the pages. First of all, Michael, as I remember the last time you spoke to us, you were telling us about your new character, Dear Stillwell. And we're on an island just south of LA called Catalina. But just so, first of all, tell us about for you and for your readers, your relatively new character, Dear Stillwell. Who is he? What do we need to know?
Well, he's the only detective on that island, and that is what drew me to creating this character and setting the books there. It's based on a true thing. The island of Catalina falls under the jurisdiction of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and they put one detective out there in a little outpost. And I just thought, like, that's almost like an American Western, you know, one sheriff in town. Like kind of high noon type stuff. And that's what I really kind of modeled this character on. He's a guy who is out there, knows he's on his own. There's always rules and regulations, but sometimes you got to bend them or bypass them when you're the only game in town. And as the lone detective, he has to cover everything. Technically, everything up to a homicide, a murder. If there's a murder on the island, then the experts, the detective squad, homicide squad, comes in from the mainland. But everything else is his domain. And that's why I love writing about it, the variety of stuff I could write about. And, you know, everything is in favor of character. So, like, I like seeing how he takes, like in this book, a graffiti case to heart because it's a blemish on what he considers a pretty beautiful place, and pursues that case with the same kind of vigor that he pursues a missing hiker case. And when that hiker's bones are found, even though it's considered a homicide in someone else's case, he's still all in pursuing it, at least from the side of the his side, which is the island.
Okay, and just an Ironwood is what specifically?
Ironwood's a tree that is native to Catalina, and it's an endangered species of tree. And so there's some metaphor work going on there. It's very hard on the outside, soft on the inside, and that's kind of how I view the character of Stillwell. And a lot of the action in this book, or a lot of the plotting, all kind of begins with the finding of bones buried beneath an ironwood tree.
And we are straight into the action with this, Michael. I adore your books anyway, but bluntly, if this book had arrived without your name on it and I just started reading, I would have been gripped from page one. I've described that front cover of a sort of single prop plane coming into land, and that plays a central part to what happens right at the beginning. Just take us into what is happening right at the beginning of this story.
Yeah, it does kind of start from bang in that airplane that's on the cover. It starts with a surveillance in the evening. They had to put some light on the cover, I guess. It can't have it all dark. But it's a little later than sunset, but they're watching and waiting. They've been tipped that a plane is going to come in and drop off drugs. On Catalina, there's one airstrip, and it's actually on the top of the mountain. They call the airport there the airport in the sky. And so they're waiting and things just go sideways. They were tipped, but then it looks like it was a setup and there's a big shootout and one deputy goes down. This is not really a spoiler. This is like in the opening chapter. And, Stillwell was in charge of this. And so he feels either technically he is to blame, like there'll be an internal investigation that takes place in the book, but that doesn't really matter. It's more like how he feels, and he feels guilty about it, and that motivates a lot of what he does through the book.
And he's very... There is murder here within these pages, and he is very angry at a particular murder, Michael, and it made me just tip back into the everyone counts or no one counts of Harry Bosch, his famous kind of maxim that he lives by. Does Stillwell live by the same kind of truth?
I think he does, but you know that is Harry's thing. So I try to find other ways of characters, including Ballard, that have that kind of code that they live by, and in these books you see that more so, because like with Bosch it's usually a murder investigation, Ballard is a cold case murder investigation. Stillwell has to handle a bunch of different things in this book, as is the true case of the detective who's out there on Catalina, and he handles each case equally. So in a way you're right, it's everybody counts or nobody counts, or every case counts or no case counts.
And your fans, of course, will be delighted and throw their hats into the sky as René Ballard is part of the story. Walk-on parts for Harry, even a tiny cameo for Maddie. I was expecting Mickey Haller to turn up, but the Lincoln lawyer doesn't. How much fun was it just acknowledging... I mean, obviously, René is a key part of the story. But just having your other friends there is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I just can't help myself. You know, I bring all these characters together. It's just fun. You know, I write like I read. And I know I love, as a reader, have like aha moments and so forth. And so I know when I'm writing them that they will have them. In a way, they're like little rewards for sticking with me, for reading other books. And I also try to... constructed so it doesn't matter if you haven't read any of my books, you know, you'll meet René in this book and Maddie and so forth. So I always enjoy doing it that way, and it makes things complicated when it comes to making TV shows, because characters from different studios are interwoven and so forth. But you know, it's really about writing like I read.
There is an undercurrent of someone else who isn't named in the book, Michael, and that is President Donald Trump. In other words, we hear about ICE raids. We hear there's a key plot point which deals with ICE officers who are not wearing uniform, which of course has been happening in the US. I'd just like you to talk a little bit about that, about your decision to include that, because ICE it absolutely sets it right. And reading it, you go, right, this was only written months ago. It feels like it's very, very now.
Yeah, well, guess what? It was written only months ago.
Okay, there you go.
You know, I set the books in the year they're published. And how could I not? And I also like to be very contemporary. I like to reflect what's going on in the world, good and bad. And so it would have been hard to not have that come into the book. I know that will probably make some readers upset, but you know, it's life. I'm covering life, and there is a vineyard. You know, this is a subplot that involves a vineyard on the island, and there is one. And the issues that come up with ICE come up on the island.
Really?
It's the same thing. I'm a reporter at heart. I was a journalist for 14 years before I started doing this, and so it's the reporter in me wants to write about real things, even though these characters are fictional. I plant them in a real world with real world issues as much as I can.
And there's a little bit of topicality with Jimmy Kimmel and Charlie Kirk being referenced, and freedom of speech, but they are, it's not, that bit isn't crucial, but again, as you say, it just roots this book very much in 2026.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to take big issues and kind of boil them down to something smaller. I like to take little issues and make them become something big. That's a lot of the fun of the writing I do is in constructing stories that you know, take something right out of the headlines or right out of the world that we know and put it down on a personal level. You know, you're referencing some kids who are just growing up and going to be part of the decision makers in the future. And, you know, it's a very, there's a very good, I think it's good, but there's a high school story involving free speech and what's going on in my country at the moment.
Just before Christmas, we had Anne Cleves on the show talking about her latest Jimmy Perez detective story. And she, of course, is responsible for all the Shetland books. And there is a very kind of insular feel to a lot of them as Jimmy Perez goes around different islands. And there's a, it reminded me a bit of Catalina, even though they're obviously very, very different places and certainly very different weather.
Yeah.
But there is that island mentality where everyone knows everyone's business, which must have been fun to get your teeth into, I think.
Yeah, it was interesting. I would, you know, this is the second book I've done with on Catalina with Stillwell. And I probably shouldn't admit this, but I think the first one, I was kind of naive. I've been visiting that island since the late 80s. But I've always been a visitor. And so I think you could read that first book, Nightshade, and say, this guy's been on the island. He gets a lot of this stuff right. But I didn't know the inside stuff. And what happened was that book came out, Nightshade came out last year, and some people reached out to me who are veterans of the island, who are part of the... And I got a really good deep dive into how that island works and who, where are the seats of power and so forth. And so I think this book is much more informed and much more realistic. And hopefully it feels like it's written by someone who lives on that island who is not a visitor. So I think I'm really happy with it. I just feel it's a much more accomplished book than the first one.
There is a great sequence, Michael, definitely my favourite in the book, where I'm not giving anything away, but Stillwell is, he's hitching a ride with a guy that he and we as the readers strongly suspect the guy he's hitching a ride with is a serial killer. And as soon as he gets into that car, I'm thinking, I thought to myself two things. One, I'm not going to be putting this down until this sequence is done. If that means I miss my stop on the tube, then so be it. I'm reading this. But also, I was wondering, I'm not sure I've read that kind of sequence before. The idea of putting your detective in a, he's in a confined space with a guy that he strongly suspects is a killer. How much fun did you have with that sequence, Michael?
That was cool. I mean, you know, I'm a big rewriter. I really think books and stories come together in the rewriting. And so I went at that scene several times, you know, with some things in mind. A, the tension has to be there and momentum. And, yeah, your question is, did I have fun? Yeah, it was a lot of fun to write that stuff. And I think as I was writing it, I'm thinking about the reader. Will the reader be kind of moved out to the edge of their seat? Hopefully so, but I knew that was like an important sequence because it's really about these two characters, and but I also knew it would be a fun sequence to read.
What changed in the rewrite? What was the difference between your original version of that and how it's ended up on the page?
Well, I'm a disciple of the school of less is more, and so when I do rewriting, I'm usually trimming. I my word count goes down. My page count goes down, because I'm really most concerned with momentum, you know. And so that, what I'm trying to do is just sharpen it and leaving what is required, but taking out as much fluff as I can, so that the reader's eyes are just zoom, zoom, zoom through the sentences and through the chapters and so forth. And so, rewriting, I start every morning by rewriting what I did the day before, so I kind of have a built-in rewrite by the time I get to the end of a draft, and then I go back and go through it again with the idea, less is more, as I'm going through it.
Less is more, but still conflict on every page, because I heard you talking about how important that is, that there has to be someone who wants something to change on every page.
Yeah, I mean, you know, writers take from other writers. Like, I never met Kurt Vonnegut. But I was a huge reader of his growing up. I just loved his books. I read about him. I read interviews with him. And he's the one who said that, make sure on every page everybody wants something. And that's really how you delineate character, you know, how what they want on all levels, from wanting to solve a murder to wanting a cigarette to wanting a drink, whatever. You try to get that on every page, and that's how you connect your character to the reader.
I'm intrigued by this method that you've got, Michael, of rewriting everything from the night before. Because as I was reading this book, I said to Simon, I can't believe that Michael does any redrafting at all, because it's all killer coming out, and you are so prolific. All of these books coming out at a rate of knots. Have you learnt this process of I'm going to rewrite stuff in the morning just to make sure that I'm, as you say, having that dynamic on every page?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've done it that way my whole career, but definitely in, you know, for the last 20-25 years, I've learned this is a good process. It not only does it, you know, sharpen, but it also, it's like I've never had writer's block. And I think one reason why is every morning I start with a rewrite. And, you know, I work on a laptop, everything's digital, but for that morning ritual, I print it out on paper, read it on paper, mark it up with a red pen, and then I start entering the changes. And it creates a momentum in your writing that carries you right through. Okay, so I just did all this rewriting, and now what's next? What's the next page? And it just carries you through. So it's also a trick, if you will, of keeping it going and not stalling out and saying, where am I going with this, or what happens next. It just gives you this this momentum that slides you into the new work of the day.
Whenever a detective series is set very specifically geographically, I'm sure there'll be locals who go, no, hang on. So Inspector Morse was a big TV series over here set in Oxford. Murders all the time happening in Oxford. I mentioned the Anne Cleves book in Shetland. People dying all the time. So many murders. Of course, it's just not true. Is there any kind of sense in Catalina that that more people are going to have to die on Catalina just to keep Stillwell happy? And it might portray the island badly.
Yeah. I mean, I'm aware of that. The truth is, there has not been a murder on Catalina since 1991.
Okay.
And that was just it was solved within an hour, because it was a domestic husband killed a wife thing. And so there's not been any mysteries, although some people say Natalie Wood was murdered. And that happened out there in the waters of the harbor. But realistically, yeah, I'm bringing a lot of violence to the island, and I always thought, like, I got to go out there, put on a baseball hat, wear dark glasses so no one recognizes me, because they might be mad at me. But, you know, like, there's a chamber of commerce in Catalina upset with me. But it turns out it's the opposite, and there's, like, a book club out there, and I've been invited to come to the book club and talk about this book as soon as it comes out. And, yeah, I think the readers are smart enough to know this is fiction. I have a duty to create, as you said, Simon, conflict, drama, momentum, all these things, and stakes. You want the stakes to be high, and what kind of crime carries the highest stakes? Pretty much it's homicide, it's murder, and so I need to do this to construct a story about a time and a place, and hopefully I get the time and place right, and the fictional part of murders every book will be accepted.
I also want to ask a question about Catalina. It's on a completely different tangent. The last time you were on, Michael, we were talking about your book in relation to one of my favourite movies, Zodiac. And so I was delighted when one of my other favourite movies, Jaws, makes a sort of fleeting appearance as far as Catalina is concerned. Because I've consumed everything I can about Jaws. That I love that movie. And I'd always assumed that it was almost entirely filmed in Martha's Harbour. But it turns out Catalina has a part in that as well. Just tell us about that.
Well, yeah, last year, going into this year, is the 50th anniversary of the movie Jaws. Mm. So there was stuff out there, and I read some stuff about how they did some reshoots. It was mostly, as you say, filmed or completely filmed out there near Martha's Vineyard. But when they came back, they thought that opening scene of the film where this woman is swimming and is attacked, possibly one of the most scary scenes in the whole movie is the opening sequence. And so they did some reshoots there in the Catalina Harbor, Avalon Harbor. And so they're very proud of their take or their part in that very small part. In that classic film.
Just on the subject of Zodiac, which is the David Fincher film, of course, 2007, which I only started watching again last week, so it's kind of fresh in my mind. What a great cast, though. Mark Ruffalo, Robert Downey Jr., Jake Gyllenhaal. I've also listened, you're no stranger to podcasts, of course, Michael, you've done many yourself, but Killer in the Code, which is your most recent series of a podcast, goes back to the Zodiac case and the Black Dahlia case, which you've spoken to us before about because you've written about that, with a kind of reveal as to who it was. So I'm not sure how the Zodiac film is going to hold up when I get to the end, because I forget how it ends. But that must have been an exciting story to tell. This is the Killer in the Code series.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially Black Dahlia. You know, as you mentioned, I wrote a fictional. They solved it fictionally. Ballard did, and Bosch's daughter in a prior book called The Waiting. So it's going all the way back to 1996. I had a book called The Poet, and there is a copycat crime to Black Dahlia. So it's a big case in the culture, I guess, of Los Angeles. So it's something I've always paid attention to. Zodiac is an intriguing case, but that was up the coast some, so I was not as steeped in that. And, you know, the movie's great. The movie leaves you thinking it's a certain person that, and that movie has seen so many people. A lot of people think, oh, it's solved. It was that guy. But that's not really the case. And so I was really kind of honored and excited when these two former homicide detectives with LAPD, who I know quite well and respect their work quite a bit, came to me and said, we think this is solved, and do you want to be involved in it? And so that's where the podcast came from. We'll do another season. We're gathering more evidence and more convincing evidence, and I think pretty soon even the police departments that have jurisdiction on these crimes are going to see it our way and put an end to these decades-long mysteries.
But in your opinion, as far as the evidence has been presented to you, the Zodiac and Black Dahlia killings are connected, and it's the same guy.
Yeah. Yes. You mentioned Marvin Margolis, and there's tons of detractors out there. And there's a lot of people who support it. And it's a very complicated case. The first season is 10 episodes long, so it's hard to explain all the evidence here. But I'm convinced, and I was convinced by two detectives that if anything ever happened to me, I've already told my wife, go to them, have them check it out, because I think they were the best of the best.
I do recommend the podcast series because it is fantastic. Killer in the Code is what you need. Michael is your host, and he takes you through all the evidence. And as Michael says, it's very difficult to sort of condense it all into one answer, but that's where you need to go for that, particularly if you're a fan of the David Fincher film. You mentioned, just going back to Ironwood and Catalina, Michael, there is a reference, it's another movie reference, later in the book, to watching a 1962 Sam Peckinpah film, Ride the High County, which I think elsewhere, I think over here was known as Guns in the Afternoon. But anyway, there is a line there which is quoted in your book. All I want to do is enter my house, Justified. This is Joel McRae's character, Steve Judd. And I read that a number of times because that to me sounded like a different way of saying everyone counts. You know, it's sort of a very neat 1962. Apparently, it's a phrase that Sam Peckinpah's father used to say. But it feels like this is, I mean, it's a fantastic line, but it seems to run through quite a lot of your work.
Yeah, I mean, I've been aware of that for a long time. And as I said, I have this view of these Catalina books as modern Westerns. And so I like making these references to Westerns. And somewhat of a gimmick also that Bosch and his partner Tash have movie nights and so forth, and those kind of movies are the movies they watch are have a meaning to them that I think connects in the books. But the idea that you've done your best, that you stood up, it's almost like that old Frank Sinatra song, My Way. When you come in your door at night, take off your gun belt, you know, talking about Westerns here, that you feel justified in what you've done and how you've lived. And you know, what would make someone like Harry Bosch feel justified is adhering to that code, everybody counts or nobody counts, and that's the same with Stillwell.
What's his first name?
There's a reference to it that is, it might be a nickname, but somebody calls him Esteban in that, and I'll leave it up to readers to think, believe or not believe his name is Steve.
Okay, all right.
This is never mentioned in the first book.
Yeah, because he's basically Stillwell or Still, even his partner calls him Still. So.
Yeah, I like that. That's why I picked that name, so you know, somebody they could call Still, you know, like be still, be calm. And you know, you always, obviously from my history, you can tell like names mean something to me. Names can be a window into character, so I spend a lot of time thinking of them.
Yeah, and speaking of the names, Michael, no one will forgive us if we don't ask you where we are. We've mentioned Renee, we mentioned Harry, and we mentioned Maddie, and we mentioned the Lincoln lawyer. What's coming next after Ironwood?
I'm doing a book that's pretty much a straight Harry Bosch book. You know, I almost can't give you a straight answer, but it's going to be billed as a Harry Bosch book. It'll be out in the fall. It's called The Hollow, and Harry's on every page, but you call it a walk-ons, right? We have some walk-ons from Renee and Mickey Haller. I couldn't help myself again. But the narrative is completely carried by Harry Bosch, and I haven't done that in a while. And it's about a case that's haunted him since he was a teenager. He grew up in this kind of house of horrors, a youth hall, once he was orphaned, and he was in this place for 5 years. It's a real place that was shut down because of the abuses, but not while he was there. And so there was a kid who Bosch had befriended who got killed in there, and it was never solved. And so something awakens that in Bosch, and he starts looking into what essentially is a 60-year-old cold case.
Should I be worried about Harry? Because he's suffered ill health quite a lot recently, and I don't like to think that you're thinking of the end.
I think I've been on your show before. I've said I'm hoping I'm writing a Harry Bosch book when I'm writing my last book. So whenever that will be. So I want to keep Harry going. But, you know, I want him to be realistic. He's in his 70s. In this book I'm writing now, about to finish, that'll come out in the fall. It's got a new knee. So, you know, a lot of my friends in their 70s got new knees or hips. And so I just want him to be as human as possible and as realistic as possible. And that helps me sell what might not really be possible, that a guy in his 70s is running around chasing murderers still. There are examples of that. And one of the detectives who brought me Killer in the Code is in his 70s, and he's still on a cold case squad for the San Mateo County Sheriff's, which is one of the counties up near where the Zodiac was. And yeah, so as long as there's some real examples of it, I'm going to have Harry keep at it, and I'm going to keep at it with Harry.
You know what Harry needs? He needs a holiday. I'm just thinking maybe Catalina Island. You know, he might want to go there again.
That would be good. It may happen. You never know.
Yeah, all right. Michael Connolly, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for spending some time with us today.
Sure. Thank you.